Good morning, and may it please the Court, Elizabeth Newman for Appellant Stephen Prowler. Your Honors, I'd like to focus first on the procedural aspects of the sentence in this case, because in this case, the District Court based the sentence partly on factors as to which it made clearly erroneous findings and partly on factors that it found to be aggravating when they were not, and that is procedural error under Carty. Turning first to the victim impact statements, which I think is the most significant of the procedural errors, although I would also argue that all of them in combination are significant as a group, and that this makes even the perhaps less significant errors significant because they can be grouped to be more significant as a whole. But at any rate, turning to the victim impact statements, the court in this case said that the harm to the victims was unquantifiable and enduring, and cited that as an aggravating factor and a reason to increase the sentence here above the guideline range of 151 to 188 months to a total of 300 months imprisonment. And the court said that on 173 of the excerpts. But when you look at the victim impact statements themselves, what you see is that the victims reported that they suffered no damage at all. Their psychological health was unimpaired, their physical health was unimpaired, their social relations were unimpaired, their appetites were unimpaired, their sleep was unimpaired, they weren't depressed. One said his sense of humor was unimpaired, they weren't suffering from any kind of family relationships were unimpaired. They were saying that they were basically unchanged from this, from what they had experienced. And the government significantly has...
How old were these children at the time of those statements?
At the time of the statements, let me see, the statements were around 2009, I think. So some of these were no longer children. I think some were over the age of majority, over 18 at this time. And the others would have been older teenagers, 16, 17. Now, the government never asked for any restitution in this case, which meant that under the government's own thinking, there was no need for any kind of remedial, therapeutic, or educational or occupational help resulting from the facts of this offense. And here, when the district court says these were such bad acts that you can't even quantify the harm to the victims was unquantifiable, and that was aggravating, meaning that it's unquantifiably huge and not unquantifiably small. When the victims themselves report no harm of that nature whatsoever, that is that results in a sentence the basis of which is simply clearly erroneous because it's not plausible. There's no foundation for it in the record that was in front of the district court. The court also based the sentence partly on what it described as the statute itself, just the fact that someone would go overseas and have illicit sexual contact with minors. But the statute itself is the statute itself. That was the reason that Mr. Prowler was before the district court in the first place. He pled to count 4 as well as count 10, and under count 4, in order to make a factual basis, he had to admit, and he did admit without any problem, that he had gone overseas with the intention, with the purpose of having illicit sexual contact with a person under the age of 18. That was the factual basis for count 4. And if he hadn't admitted to that, he couldn't have made a factual basis to count 4. And so for the district court to use that as an independently aggravating factor is clearly erroneous. It is a mischaracterization of the nature of the offense because it uses the offense itself as an independently aggravating factor to the offense itself.
Why wasn't the judge just looking at the underlying circumstances, the nature of the offense?
The judge did look at the underlying circumstances and said so, Your Honor. But what the judge also did and also said was that she was also looking, at these other circumstances. The language that she used both in her oral pronouncement of sentence and to some degree in her written order that she issued after the sentencing hearing, both show that she considered as independently aggravating the statute itself, the fact that he kept a diary, and the fact that he had entered a guilty plea. I don't think that, I think that it's a fair reading to say that she considered that based on what she said, that these were independently aggravating things. If you look, for example, at page 122 and 123 of the excerpts, you see that she says he kept a diary, the handwritten notes, these are factors. And she goes on to describe the things that are reflected in the diary, which she also uses and which we're not contesting as proper or improper bases for enhancing the sentence, but she also says the diary. On 173 of the excerpts, which is her written order, she says, again, that this was a very significant thing, that he kept handwritten daily journals. The entries included graphic descriptions. And she says on 122, the diary, the handwritten descriptions, the recruiting of some youngsters, and so forth, these are all factors the court has considered. She's saying that the diary itself is a factor that the court has considered, but the diary, of course, is just a diary, and even in the sections that the government has provided in its sealed excerpts, which, of course, the government has provided in order to show the improper sexual contact that Mr. Prowler had.
You think she might have been concerned by the content of the diary, what he wrote in the diary?
What he wrote was an account of his improper sexual contact, but he wrote about other things as well, obviously, and that's reflected even in the excerpts, the sealed excerpts that the government provided. He wrote about his events that happened at the school where he taught. For example, on sealed excerpt 88, he talks about his frustration that someone seems to have made off with some of his school supplies. He talked about U.S. election returns and how he monitored them on sealed excerpts 89. He talked about spending time with a friend, an adult friend, on sealed excerpts 91 and how they watched The Lord of the Rings and how he borrowed a Crosby, Stills, and Nash album or a tape. I mean, his diary is just a diary. She does talk independently about the facts that the diary also contains about the things that he did for which he was in front of the district court to be sentenced. But to say that it's independently aggravating that he kept a diary or that he entered a guilty plea or that he violated the statute is simply to mischaracterize the 3553A factors in this case. If the court has no further questions about this issue, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Assistant United States Attorney Sherilyn Garnett, and I represent the government in this case.
Yes.
This court should affirm the 25-year sentence imposed on Mr. Prowler. The court did not abuse its discretion in imposing the above-guideline sentence, and the sentence was both procedurally and substantively reasonable. I'll address some of the comments made by the appellant in this case. First, the diary was not simply a diary. It contained content of the abuse that Mr. Prowler inflicted upon these minor victims. The diary, and I read every word of the diaries that he put together, it documented the extent and duration of the child exploitation that Mr. Prowler was engaged in. And the court's comment regarding the diary, from the context of the comment, it is clear the court was referring to the content of the diary. In fact, the court specifically acknowledged one of the arguments that the government had made based on excerpts directly from the diary, that defendant had paid other minors to other minor victims who had become older, 15 or 16, to go out and find younger minors as young as 12 or 13 that he could subsequently exploit. That information came only from the diaries. Prowler subsequently admitted it, but it was clear from the court's reference to that information that Judge Marshall saw the diary, was discussing the contents of the diary. As to the victims of the offense in this case, Judge Marshall found that they may not have understood the full impact of the harm that that Mr. Prowler's conduct had caused. These were young boys, and at the time of the victim impact statement, some of them were still just 15, 16, or 17 years old. They were paid for sex, and again, may not understand that they were engaging in an adult act. and that it could have an emotional impact on them. Judge Marshall was entitled to look at this information and come to the conclusion that it wasn't a mitigating factor, but an aggravating factor, and that's exactly what she did. It was a reasoned decision, and it should be entitled to deference. With respect to any other procedural errors, the government, it's the government's position there were no procedural errors in this case. Both parties agree that the guideline calculations were correct this time around, and those calculations alone would result in a sentence of more than 10 years. In fact, the guidelines would be 151 to 188 months in this case. Judge Marshall also recognized that the guidelines were advisory, and she also looked at the 3553A factors in this case and determined that the factors that she acknowledged in both her oral and written pronouncement were aggravating factors. And again, her decision was based on a reasoned and sound judgment, and it's entitled to deference in this case. So unless the court has any specific questions regarding...
There was some problem with the way in which she framed the special conditions.
I will address that, Your Honor.
Right.
First of all...
Of supervised release.
Yes, Your Honor. There are specific conditions that the parties are still contesting on appeal. The defendant did not object before the district court to those particular conditions. I believe it was condition 4, 15, and 17. And so those conditions should be reviewed for plain error. And in this case, the defendant has not shown, with respect to conditions 15 and 17, the occupational or so-called occupational restrictions, that those conditions, that he was prejudiced by those conditions. He has not shown that had the district court made specific findings regarding those restrictions, that the outcome would have been different. In this case, it's the government's position that the defendant was incarcerated prior to him being arrested on the offense that is at issue in this case. And so he wasn't employed at the time at the time of his arrest. The higher standard for looking at occupational restrictions would not apply here. But even if the court were to apply it, again, he has not shown prejudice. With respect to the computer restrictions, it is clear that the defendant used a computer to commit this offense as well as his relevant conduct. He admitted that he went to an internet cafe and uploaded images of child pornography. The government also pointed out in its briefs that the defendant had used a computer to share his collection of photographs of the children that he exploited with at least one other predator. He also downloaded that predator's collection to his own computer. So it's clear that the defendant used a computer to engage in the conduct that he's charged with and was convicted of, and so the computer-related restriction is appropriate in this case and is not a significant restriction on liberty. Again, if the court has any additional questions, I'd be happy to ask them at that time. Otherwise, I'd reserve the time.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Weren't there several conditions where there's no issue as to... there were conditions, I think, 5 and 9, which
yes,
were
Your
beyond...
Honor.
They were in the judgment order, but they weren't in the judge's oral pronouncement.
Yes, and the government agrees that to the extent that the written conditions conflict with the oral pronouncement, that should be changed.
We just have to vacate that and send it back for her to do what's required.
Yes, Your Honor, or this court. Everybody agrees as to what changes should be made. So, yes, you could just vacate it.
Okay.
All right.
Ms. Newman.
Thank you. If I may just address briefly the supervised release conditions, particularly the occupational restrictions 15 and 17. The government's has said that they're not really occupational restrictions, or they don't matter, or the court made findings, and that's not true. There are two conditions that have to be made before occupational restrictions may be imposed. That is, the court has to find a reasonably direct relationship between the offense conduct and the occupation, and there was none here. Mr. Prowler was a teacher, and there's no evidence anywhere that he ever sexually approached a child within his school community. And then the court also has to have reason to believe that the defendant would commit similar conduct without the restriction. There's no way to find that in this case, and, of course, the district court didn't find it. On the plain error issue and the harm, the prejudice to Mr. Prowler on this plain error review, the conditions affect Mr. Prowler's substantial rights because they affected the outcome of the district court proceeding. And I would point the court to U.S. versus Barsoomian and U.S. versus Abucci, which both find plain error prejudice with respect to supervised release conditions for that very reason. And they also seriously affect the fairness of the sentencing proceedings because they're sentencing conditions that were imposed without adequate justification, which, again, is what this court said in Barsoomian. Thank you very much, Your Honors. Okay.
Thank you.
Just quickly, Your Honor.
What?
Can I respond? Or no?
Well, you've had your chance.
Okay.
We're going to submit United States of America versus Prowler. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments. Our next case on the calendar was Emma versus Astor, but that's submitted on the briefs. Our next two cases involving Fidal Machinery, 55719 and 56494, are submitted on the briefs, and that'll end our session for this morning. Thank you all very much.